This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. James Baldwin is recapturing the American imagination more than 30 years after his death. The themes of his writing are today's headlines: systematic police violence, voter suppression, and marginalization of Black Americans. Baldwin's sophisticated and nuanced political ideas were decades ahead of the public debate. The book Understanding James Baldwin offers historical and personal context for each of his works. Author Mark Dudley joins me in the studio now. He's a professor of English at North Carolina State University. Mark Dudley, welcome to The State of Things.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
With Baldwin's voice, why do you think it feels so present today?
I think that Baldwin was, as everything you just enumerated, I think Baldwin was decades ahead of his time. Seeing things in the 1950s and 60s and 70s that we are just seeing now, things are just shaking out in every headline that we see today. Speaking to themes that are timeless in everything that he wrote.
Remind us, he is becoming more popular. He is part of more and more Americans' consciousness. But for those who don't know much about Baldwin, remind us who he was.
I like to introduce him whenever I teach a class as being sort of this amalgam of all sorts of great things. I mean, he was an essayist first. I think he speaks first with an essayist voice, speaking about social issues that concern everybody. But he was a fiction writer, and at his best, there's nobody better. He is highly anthologized, so he's a short story writer. He wrote 6 novels in his lifetime. As I suggested, an essayist, and one of the things I suggest in my book as I wrap things up is he speaks with a poet's voice, and he dabbled in poetry in his last years of his life as well. But in the middle of all of that, he was what I would call a social justice warrior before it was really a thing, and it's become a thing now.
Well, and let's talk more about his writing. We'll talk about the social justice aspect of his work, which, if you know anything about him, that's what you know. Yeah. But he was a novelist, and he even wrote a romantic novel about that had a white protagonist. And this really kind of shook up at least the Black writing world, right? I mean, talk about his power as a novelist and his reach and imaginative reach as a novelist.
I think the work you're speaking about is Giovanni's Room, and it's funny you suggest that as sort of an entry point into talking about Baldwin in fiction. Sometimes I like to shake my students up a little bit by introducing them to Baldwin with that work, because and I give you an example. I just taught a course on Black literature, a survey course, and I introduced Baldwin with Giovanni's Room, and several of the people in the classroom didn't really get the racial element at work. We're a little surprised to find out that the protagonist was white, and as the more they read, that this had nothing to do with race, or at least ostensibly on the surface had nothing to do with race. So in this text comes out in 1956. He's speaking to ideas of equality that have nothing to do with race, and this book in and of itself was kind of hard for him to shop because it was hard to categorize. Mm-hmm. He's writing this book at a time where he was being sort of egged on by publishing houses and writers alike and the public with their own expectations to write about what he would call Negro life. And this was his sort of thumbing of the nose at the establishment. And his sort of establishing himself as an artist first. This was a grand experimentation, and I think it succeeded.
But his willingness to dive into that space, which would be deliberately uncomfortable, and stay there.
That's what artists do.
That's what good artists do.
Absolutely.
And that's what Baldwin did. But other artists say, well, you know, I'm good at this, and they expect me to write about race, so I think that's just what I'll do. I'll get published, and who knows, maybe I'll change something. But for Baldwin, it was always about staying in that middle. Would you say about staying miserably uncomfortable in that middle space, forcing people to join him there and feel what it's like not to resolve the problem?
Absolutely. And I think, not to go off on a tangent, but this is what conversations are all about, I think that is where his real sticking point was with his great mentor, Richard Wright, who really could not sort of free himself of the shackles of race and racial conversations. And Baldwin was able to sort of weave in and out and do what he wanted as an artist first. And again, that's bold.
And it, as you say, it really did make him the targets of critics from every end of the multiple spectrums that he, I mean, I think in many ways he exposed spectra that we didn't even know existed and by way of the critics that he attracted. Because so many people would argue that he is was sort of despondent, that ultimately he was in despair about race and race relations in the United States. Again, he's a pretty difficult guy to pin down, but how would you describe this?
I'd start first with the characteristic that's broad and bold, and I suggest he is very realistic. And so if you're wanting to be realistic, you've got to confront your demons. Everything that Baldwin writes, and that's sort of the framing of my book, is that everything that he writes, from the poetry to the essays to the fiction, is confessional in nature. And he starts in that personal space and expands outward, and that's what all great essays do. So even when he's not writing an essay, he's really sort of taking on the vestiges of a great essayist and keeping them uncomfortable, as you say. That's where an artist lives. That's what an artist's job is. And I think one of the things that he suggested again and again in his life was that he was, sort of going back to his roots in the church, he was his destiny was to sort of testify on behalf of his fellow man and fellow woman. And he did that to the end of his life.
It's interesting that you say that and you include that in your book, the idea of bringing forward ideas or institutions that he had rejected. So while he rejects the church, he understands that he learned something from that. And he kept the good parts. He didn't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
But he also reminded his audience of the bad parts, too.
Oh, yeah.
So it was very mixed bag.
But let's talk about this and get a good example of why people found him so difficult, his contemporaries, to place and to get a handle on. Here's a conversation that he had with Margaret Mead in 1951. And by the way, this is available on YouTube. It's free, and the entire nearly two-hour conversation is there. I think there was more of it, but there's 2 hours of it recorded there. So here's a clip where Margaret Mead is challenging him. She really wants him to be an optimist about race relations, right? And he's not having it.
Change has got to occur here, within this country and within the Soviet Union. And in China.
But it won't. But it won't.
Well, then why are you alive? Won't. Why do you stay alive one day?
Well, something will come after it.
Well, but if not on this planet.
America is not about to change.
Wait a minute. Not on this planet, then. I mean, if America...
I'm committed to the human race, but I know that America will not change. However paradoxical that may sound, however contradictory that may sound.
There's an excerpt from a 1971 conversation between James Baldwin and Margaret Mead, talking with Mark Dudley about his book, Understanding James Baldwin. America will not change, he says. So why write a book?
Well, her question, I think, is a valid one. I think she expressly says in that clip, you know, what's the point? Why get up in the morning? That's the perennial question. I mean, I think everything that Baldwin wrote and everything that he would sort of package in an answer, it's going to be messy, but would suggest that the point is surviving. The point is to be able to testify to that survival, if nothing else. And that's all he's got to offer. That's the best that he can offer. And I was saying to your producer earlier, I was talking about Baldwin's sort of investment in what he would call sort of a blues culture. Everything about what Baldwin wrote, romantic or not, if you want to use that word loosely, is steeped in the blues. The essence of the blues is survival and testifying to it. And there's something beautiful about that, and we share that in common. There's a universality to that. And therein, I think, for him lies the value. That's the point.
Well, and the blues is famous for the blue note, which is not contained. It is not a legal part of the pentatonic scale, right? So to play the note that shouldn't be there to make the song the characteristic blues song is what he's saying. If we don't play that note that doesn't belong and live in that moment, you don't have the blues and you don't have my song.
And therein also is a great example of sort of the essence of rebellion. Everything about the black spirit, Baldwin would say, sort of been the essence of rebellion, surviving when the community shouldn't have survived for all these generations.
And the hope, let's talk about change not occurring, because in that conversation, they get into even more heated arguments over this notion of optimism. Margaret Mead, who recognizes her privilege, she's very much with him on where we should be on race, but he keeps bringing her back on this question of subjectivity. You are not living in the space I'm living in, and you keep going out to this future where we will all, you know, join and sing Kumbaya. I can't go there. You can't go there either if you're not me. And if you don't start with me, then your hope for the future is really nothing but a fantasy.
Absolutely. Baldwin sounds like he's spinning fantasies when he talks about love. Because that love thematic is in everything that he wrote. But it's less about sort of this idealism, and it's more about a realization of something that he thinks can be gotten, which is love equates to understanding. And so your suggestion to your point there, Margaret Mead may have all the best intentions in the world, but she doesn't truly understand his position because she didn't have that shared experience that he has as a black man. There's a great clip also. You talk about treasure trove. YouTube is a treasure trove for all kinds of great things. There was a great clip on YouTube in which he's actually debating another academic on the Dick Cavett Show. And he's talking about the very same thing. Academics share a certain space, but that academic also fails to understand him and truly understand the space from which he speaks.
Perhaps why he wrote a romantic novel, that real love comes from this kind of deep empathy of sharing, not just negotiating what we can get from each other and the pleasures and joys and mitigating the sorrows, but in fact being in me and with you, which is very hard for people to understand, especially because he also he sounded angry. So you're thinking this is a political diatribe and you're actually listening to kind of a Zen philosopher to some degree. I mean, he seemed to embody all of that.
He did. The anger that you say you hear is frustration. Because again, it all is about understanding and coming to that point of connectivity, which all of his protagonists strive for and always seem to sort of come up short in the end. Do I have time for one more comment?
Please. Yeah.
Yeah. You were suggesting something about sort of you were talking about the Margaret Mead conversation. Oh man, I lost my train of thought.
Well, what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about art and give you a chance to gather yourself, because we were talking too about this question of why bother, right? And again, with the anger and the frustration and the fact that he's living in this deeply uncomfortable space constantly, and all of his art comes from that space. He does talk about writing and about art as a process for change, even though he says America will never change. He's engaged in a process of change and he understands it. Let's listen to this clip.
If you can describe it, you can control it, and if you can control it, you can outwit it. You can get beyond it if you can describe it. In order to describe it, you have to face it. And I think that's true. I know that's been true for me, you know, insofar as you can ever say that you, I don't think anything has ever really escaped, but it's perpetually being overcome.
There we go. James Baldwin talking about the role of his art and art in general. I'm joined by Mark Dudley, who's the author of Understanding Baldwin. Tell us more about that, about this notion that, again, it's not about bringing about some change. It's about participating in a process that opens possibilities, and he doesn't know how it's going to end, right?
None of us do. Right. That's the grand lesson. Right. But I think the other lesson there, again, is there is a, between those divisional points or across those divisional lines, there are points of connectivity if we just are brave enough to face them. And I know I was going to say earlier, I was going to suggest to you something about, you were saying something about taking. Baldwin constantly talks about the sort of the bravery, the courage that's invested in the giving and the giver. Every time we give of ourselves, not expecting something in return, we're gambling something. And only the brave can actually go into that, fully sort of self-aware of what we are doing in that moment. And the artist, he suggests, does that every time he writes something or she writes something. They're laying their souls bare with the expectation of garnering nothing in return. So you were talking about critics coming at him from every corner. He was fully aware of that, and I think fully ready to take on the mantle of sort of sacrificer there.
The readiness is all.
Absolutely.
Wrote the bard in the mouth of Hamlet. So talk more about that courage, but also, you know, we're talking about his relevance 30 years after his death, et cetera. Okay, he's becoming more popular, but I'm wondering, the impact of his message is so difficult, and especially in America, which is so absolutely antithetical to anything that has to do with confronting, right? It's always looking to the future and the solution and without bothering to confront yourself. How do your students take him now, your undergrads, and what do they take from Baldwin when you teach him?
My undergrads in particular are always looking for, again, points of universality. Even when I'm teaching a course that's on African-American history or literature, you know, I do 20th century American literature, but I also do African-American literature. And if I have a predominantly white class, they're looking for for points of connectivity, but that's fine. What I try to get them to see in Baldwin and see in, you know, really all great literature is that there are going to be these points of connectivity that we can also glom onto. So, you know, Baldwin, anything that I look at that Baldwin gives us is always talking about living or life, living in a space that's on the margins. And everybody can relate to that. You know, I like to say to students, you know, the one thing we all have in common, even if I look across the grand mass of people before me and they sort of look homogenous, I'll say, but your experiences are singular. You know, I'm a city guy. I don't know what it's like to grow up in rural America. Talk to me. So Baldwin is always kind of coming from that space of marginality, no matter what it is that he's talking about. And I think we can all often connect with that.
He also understood deeply what white supremacy was all about, and he talked about it in that very context, understanding himself. He said what every artist does is you have to look in the mirror, and everything comes out of that subjectivity. And what white supremacy and bigotry is all about is sort of objectifying the things in yourself you don't like.
Absolutely.
The things you hate, and that's what narcissism is all about, why we have a narcissist now leading the country. It's what nihilism is all about, right? And that's why we have a nihilist leading the country, because we've refused to face, right? We're not going to take it on board, so we project it. And that mirror suddenly has a ghost image of someone who does not look like us.
Absolutely. But we have a long-standing history of doing that as a nation, but also also just as individuals. Again, I keep coming back to this point of the universal. None of us likes to look in the mirror and to start nitpicking or denigrating or whatever. But self-evaluation is going to be important. All of his essays in the 60s were all about that, or starting in the 50s were about self-evaluation. America's not ready to do that. So coming back to that Margaret Mead clip, he's a realist in that moment. Until we're ready to do this as a collective, we're never going to get there. But what's the alternative?
Well, it's good that he's coming up again and people are considering it. And who knows, this may be the moment.
I hope so. I'm gonna be the perennial optimist.
You be the optimist, okay? And then I will just run out of time, and we'll leave it with you. Mark Dudley is a professor of English at NC State, the author of Understanding James Baldwin. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Mark, what a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, friend.
And of course, you can sign up for a newsletter there as well, stateofthings.org. Get a preview of our daily lineup. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.